101, a version 1 podcast.
You're all extremely welcome this morning. So we have hopefully an interesting discussion today. Pick up from where we started there, that discussion around, look, this is algorithms, it is data science, it's how we use data, it's how we drive our businesses. But the ethical questions associated with that, we're going to try and touch on many topics within that. I know that in the room, we've got people from many different industry sectors, from finance to healthcare to education to many, many different sectors. There's no one single answer here. But hopefully we'll touch from high-level concepts of ethics through to regulation, through to privacy, but hopefully well beyond that, and the implications of algorithms and so forth. So you're very, very welcome today. So on our panel, first of all, we have Joan Cahill from the Centre for Innovative Human Systems at Trinity College, Niall O'Neill, Chief Strategy Officer with OneView Healthcare, Dr. Catherine O'Keefe, Chief Ethicist with Castlebridge, and Garvin Callan, Financial Services Technical Transformation Advisor with 101. I'm going to go to some of the audience questions. Yeah. There are a ton of questions, okay, so we'll take some. So I'm trying to group them based on what people have asked. There's a set of questions asked in different ways about, can we give an example of a real company really baking this in as a framework into their day-to-day? How do they use it? And maybe Catherine, because that's, you know, you're definitely in that area. Mm-hmm. Just talk about companies that you've seen who have effectively baked that into what they do.
So I can't really talk about a lot of clients because of confidentiality. But you know, I have seen, there's a couple startups that we've worked with. I can talk about this one because they're happy to have us known that we work with them. They're a company called MedXNote. They're again, you know, a small targeted solution for a gap that they saw, which was risks to and invasions of patient privacy when it came to medical messaging. So, you know, if you're in the hospital situation, a lot of the communications are pretty old and out of date, and doctors still have pagers. When it came to getting medical imaging from one department to another, a lot of times things would break down. So doctors would just take a picture of the x-ray and WhatsApp it or Snapchat or use whatever messaging system they had to get it to the person who needed it quickly. Niall, the person who founded MedXNote, was working in a medical imaging department and realized what was going on because things kept on breaking down and said, this is risky, let's fix it. So he saw a very targeted need to, again, help people, and he built a simple medical messaging company that is encrypted, it is compliant, and it makes sure that you can integrate it into hospital systems. So a lot of the time, what I think is helpful is looking at things from an ethics of care perspective. It's having the expertise to see what needs people have and fulfilling that. And that can actually be a very good way of developing a business.
Another example, and maybe one to relate to for most people working in maybe medium to large organizations, is to make interventions in processes that are already in place. Mm-hmm. So most organizations have a product approval process, or most organizations have a product lifecycle review process. What I've seen happening that has been super effective is changing the mandates in those committees and in those structures. So the example, customer experience has become a brief now. It's become a discipline and it's become a role in every organization. And I've worked with organizations, I've been involved in organizations, and I've been the customer experience leader in organizations where I forced this a little bit, where we looked and we gave the veto to the customer people who are ultimately, you know, I kind of relate them to the internal ethicists. They're ultimately the people responsible for, you know, the value exchange with the customer. So, you know, for a product to get improved, the veto should go to the customer experience people, who should have a veto that's based on fact and based on data, and indeed the life cycle approval process, which is just the annual, you know, revalidation of that, again, giving, you know, and it doesn't have to be the customer person, it can be the business leader, it's the right person in the organization with the right mindset, giving the right mandate and vetoes to make sure we have those checks and balances in place. And that's, it sounds brutal, but again, in the maturity, you know, sometimes you have to put in those hard measures to change the mindset so that the collective can mature.
And there's a couple of people asked the questions around, are there KPIs we can use to assess ourselves to say, are we actually assessing ethics in what we do?
Okay, so you can have KPIs around, you know, the process of embedding ethics. You know, so for instance, in some of my work in healthcare around safety management, and you're looking at safety promotion, and you see, well, are people attending meetings that are is actually evaluating it? You know, so that that's actually what you're doing. But just to make the point that the remit of ethics and these questions isn't solely just the technology. So if we take a systems perspective, you know, the protections need to be thought of in terms of the technology. But the example, for example, that Niall gave, you know, of, say, using video monitoring and whether you put certain protections in terms of how you implement the technology to protect a person's privacy. But there's other things that you need to do. So beyond the technology, there's projections around processes and training. So staff know that, you know, there's less care, if you like, embedded in this because the technology is automating certain aspects of care. But therefore, my role is changing and I'm trained to understand that I still need to come in and put my eyes on someone because care is still about not just responding to a problem, but just showing compassion and empathy and having a conversation with someone. So you're looking at process and training and culture. And the technology is part of that. So it's situated within a systems. So we're not just stopping at how we're embedding ethics in the technology. It's everything around it, you know.
Can I ask a question? So there's a couple of them here using external audits or potentially regulators being interested in you proving your algorithms, or and it relates to GDPR having obligations to explain how did automated processing happen. Have you seen effective, you know, that kind of external intervention into algorithms? And is it something that's in any way meaningful or possible?
It depends on, again, you know, how complex your algorithms are. A lot of the time what you end up measuring is the impact. And you know, is there an outsized impact on one demographic versus another? So one of the things you should be looking at is, again, before you deploy anything, doing a risk impact assessment. We do a lot of that. And again, figuring, again, where could things go wrong? What could the impacts be that you need to worry about? What is a good outcome? What is a fair outcome? What outcomes are you looking for? And then you can measure the outcomes you get against that, even if the actual algorithm is itself is too complex, or if you're using, again, deep learning where you can't really get into the black box and figure out what's going on. So when it comes again to just a regulatory explainability, what is required in GDPR is not giving people the code to analyze themselves, but to explain the logical decisions by which things are made and how things are impacted. So, we're looking at the outcomes more than the analysis of the code itself.
But there's a lot of calls for this. And I certainly, you know, there's all calls around, you know, transparency and disclosure around algorithms. So, you've got data and processes and you have a model and you come up with these predictions and you want to look at bias and the ethical quality of these predictions. And like personally speaking, I think absolutely there should be transparency and accountability. And some of the, you know, the partnership program for prosperity and looking at building well-being and as an outcome in system designs is calling for it. But I haven't seen any actual interventions to say, like, this is how we do it. Now, I'm not as close to that, but actually, how do we make ourselves transparent? And, you know, this goes into the space of, you know, IP and sharing commercially sensitive information. Yeah. No organization wants to do that. But there's a social responsibility. So there needs to be, I suppose, more investment in terms of how do we communicate that and what's rigorous enough and scientific enough.
Yeah. There's a scenario in the UK at the moment around visa application processing and settled status. And there are algorithms being used in order to not make final decisions. So I believe there's still humans in the loop, but the algorithms are still classifying. And when you have classification, you know, you may have confirmation bias on the behalf of the people who are then using that information. And those algorithms were introduced without In fact, they're only that the use was only found when human rights lawyers went to see the system being used and started asking questions about how the system was working. So a complete lack of transparency. Mm-hmm. And this is still happening in the UK at the moment, you know, the pressure to say, well, you have to be transparent about mm-hmm. how this algorithm is working. And the Home Office is saying, well, if we provide that transparency, then people will game the system.
Yep.
but there has to be a way, you know, a path forward where you cannot have this black box that is making these decisions, human rights decisions with no transparency, no governance, no accountability.
Related to that, there's one that is, I'll read the question as is because it's well phrased. That's what the data says is a common response when algorithmic unfairness is discussed. So what questions, not of the algorithm in this case, what questions should we ask of the data to assess its fairness? So that can be the profile that we've used. How do we actually assess that?
I always like to think of the practice of the five whys. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, that's at the very heart of it. And I think we should organize ourselves and our patterns around working with data and analytics should be in the five whys. So, you know, the theory is by the time you get to the fifth why, if you keep asking the whys, you'll get to the real truth. We talked about it a little bit earlier on. I mean, you know, everyone fights with the data. You know, depending on who produces it and who's consuming it. But I mean, in business, that's the way it feels every day. One group produce some data, another group will fight with the data. So I think the five whys is very important. Can I link back to the previous point we had as well? Just an example of an organization who I think is doing the right thing in this. So ING, a bank in the Netherlands, but it's across Europe. But 6-7 years ago, they launched a program, and I'm going to use a local terminology, and I've done some of these as well, called Let's Get Digital. So this was all about demystifying really what digital was in the context of coming out of the crisis when employees in the organization were worried that the mobile and online was going to close every branch. So you know, they made a movement to say, well, it's not going to be like that. Strategically, that's not the answer. It's not binary. It's how can we use digital to augment what we do in branches and to be able to expand how customers can look after themselves, and ultimately we can look after them. They've taken that a step forward, and they've launched a Let's Get Analytical. Again, for just another euphemism, and they've set up and they're working very closely. I forget, Joan, the university, mm-hmm. but they have done this in partnership with the university in Holland, and they've set up a formal program for formal skills development and knowledge and understanding. But the essence is demystifying it and knowing the truth, having this conversation at a team level and at an individual level in an organization is a very good place to start.
Okay. I have two more I'm going to take. Okay. And the first one of those, I think is it's got neither algorithms in it nor data in it, but I'll just throw it out because somebody asked it. Should the company that supplies stationery to the White House use to sign detention orders cancel the contract until a more ethical administration gets in?
I take it that's a question.
Got ethics in it.
I'd say that the water company should probably do it first, because there's a humongous debt that the White House hasn't bothered to pay the bill, so shut the water off. but yeah, there are definitely it's a question that stationary company probably should be making asking of itself.
But not talking specifically about that case, but in general, we're talking
making profit
about
out of
the idea that regardless of what we do as business, there can be downstream uses of and customers that we have for which we may choose the implications. In other words, so is that something that businesses, how far should they go to ask the implications of what it is their services are, which could be financial services, could be other things like that. Something that goes beyond the remit of the service itself. Is that something that actually extends into our ethics space?
Yes.
Yes, absolutely.
It's something, again, that businesses are asking of themselves right now in the U.S., whether or not they should continue a contract. It's something that we've actually considered in Castlebridge at some points is, is this a client that, a client that is not listening to us, that wants to use us as kind of a patch to ethics wash a little bit? Do we need to fire the client? Are they actually listening and trying, or is this a business relationship that doesn't really need to continue?
Yeah, I think it's already happening. I'd like to think I'm part of the gig economy. I'm freelance. I work with a portfolio of clients, but I choose those clients based on their intent, their purpose, their compass, if you want to say, and the project and what we're trying to do. But look, that's just my perspective. But look, read this, go out and have a look at millennials, go out and have a look at the gig economy, what's happening in human capital is actually manifesting itself in this. It is happening from the ground up. If we talk about AI, and if we talk about millennials and the Gen Z and the next generation, they will just grow up, AI will be invisible for them. But actually what will be invisible, I think, at the same time will be that moral compass, because and that has an implication for us in business as we're thinking about, how do we counteract the bias in our teams and inclusion and diversity? I think if you connect the dots, you could find like-minded people to solve the inclusion and diversity challenge that I think we do have. But it's finding those complements, I think, would be important.
I'm going to ask one last question, and it's just from what's here, and I'll take two kind of questions that were asked together. I'm going to ask Joan specifically this.
Because I want to answer that other question. I will answer your question.
One question is, which is, with more automation, new technology, how is it affecting our lives and the lives of those in the future? And there's another one who's sort of AI in the same space. How is this affecting us as humans? How is this algorithms, data, using it, shifting us, changing us? And ethically, what does that mean?
Okay, so there's a lovely design term, ontological design, and it comes from philosopher of ontology and questions of being and meaning, Martin Heidegger. And it's around that, when we're designing, we're designing what it means to be. And there is a line that we talked about the other day, and it's a quote from someone called Fry, who's a philosopher in the UK, and he talks about, in designing, we are also being designed. So, there's this relationship between what we're designing and who we are and how we are and our relationships in the world. And the two simple ideas of machine-human interaction and human-human interaction. And lots happening in that space. So how we're changing the relationships between ourselves and machines and computers, and how technologies are becoming very much embedded in our lives, changes how we interact with each other. And that's just, there's such a paradigm shift. So, and not just the easy examples of, like social media. They're not easy in the sense that, but they're accessible to everyone. How we talk to friends, I don't know how many people have held out on using emojis. I'm holding out on using emojis. but just what we consider part of our lexicon, how we speak and how we are. So it's quite fundamental. And not all of it is negative. So I actually see that technology can be very transformative and positive, but with the right safeguards. But it's not so easy to say what those safeguards are, because now and 6 months and 9 months and 12 months, the ground keeps shifting and the technologies are moving faster. And what we are accepting, and certainly what different cohorts in society, whether you're talking about age-related, younger people versus older people, what they consider acceptable. I had the pleasure when I was working with OneView of doing research with older adults, and we were looking at having, smart technologies in the home. And the amount of hilarious conversations I had with people saying, well, what are all these young people doing? And what are they thinking? And just pick up the phone and, and one of the big things that came out of it was, if you have all these technologies, fundamentally, my role as a person engaging with my children or my brothers and sisters will change, because if I'm monitored in some way, people don't need to contact me. So that idea of social and psychosocial dimensions of our being, it's massive. It's underestimated, So I think that's, it's a good question.
Okay.
We have a practical example in some of the hospitals we work with in the US market. meals and medication are delivered by robots to the wards or the units. Now, the robot doesn't take it into the room to the person. A human will pick it up off the robot and bring it into the room. So you're automating a process, but you are not removing the human contact in terms of the person that actually gives the medication or the person that gives the food. But you could get the robot to go in and just, you know, back up to the bed and start beeping. But that, you know, there's a reason why that hasn't been done, because that last human interaction is really, really important. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so let's wrap up with just thoughts from yourselves. I suppose this is a room of people across diverse industries, diverse profiles, diverse roles. We've talked about the importance of ethics throughout, regardless of whether you are directly the data scientist, whether you are the citizen data scientist with needing that extra button for the, I'll have the ethics button now, or whether you're the business, who's a business leader who's actually driving where the business is going, but actually considering how that technology can enable where your business goes into the future. How do technologists, data professionals, business professionals actually build ethics in a meaningful way into their roles, into their organization, into the approach of defining their strategies? Somebody want to just round out with thoughts on that?
Wrote an entire book on it. One of the things is figuring out your company's values, what your values are, whether they match the company's or not. But you need to integrate it in from every stage of your organization. There needs to be tone from the top. You need to have governance and communication across the organization so that you know what your company's ethical values are, how they should be implemented, what outcomes you expect, what you want to see, what you want to be contributing to. Part of that is, again, listening to each other, communicating across the organization. Part of that is making sure you have the various voices in the room. So you bring in the experts for the stuff that you're not as familiar in. You bring in, as part of the design process, the people who will be harmed by or could be harmed by what you're doing. So you try to get as many voices into the room, as many perspectives, so that you can figure out what we're missing in our data. You know, is there a complete blind spot that we have that we need to be addressing? It's figuring out what you're trying to look for, figuring out what questions you need to be asking. And a lot of that is, you will be experts in your own area. What are the other voices and expertise that you need to be listening to, bringing them in?
Excellent. Okay, I'm going to wrap it up with that. Thank you very much, all four of our panels, Joan, Niall, Catherine, Garvin. I hope that was useful and informative.
Thank you for listening to the 101 podcast. If you would like more information about any of our podcasts or our guests, visit us at version1.com/1-0-1.